Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Paul Kitagake's parents and grandparents were interned during World War II, but like so many Japanese Americans, they never talked about their experience. He learned about Japanese American internment when he was a 16-year-old in a 10th grade class in San Mateo, California in 1970. And he writes that he was shocked and angry at how his parents and grandparents were treated. They were Americans. How could they be locked up behind barbed wire many miles from their homes? And how could they have let me grow up in our racially mixed, middle-class, suburban neighborhood in South San Francisco, in an area where Dad and my uncle were teachers, without ever mentioning the executive order and how it had affected their lives? And he's referring to the executive order that was signed in 1945. By Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The last internment camp was closed by the end of 1945, but the trauma and the lasting effects on the community is still felt by many today. To better understand what they went through, Paul Kitagake tracked down the subjects of more than 60 photographs taken by Dorothy Lange, Ansel Adams, and other photographers. And he photographed them or their children, and they all say they are determined to make sure this never happens again. And Paul is out with a beautiful new book. It's a photo book, also with stories about the people that Paul met and photographed, and it's called Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. Paul Kitagake is an award-winning photographer and videographer who has traveled the world covering natural and human-caused disasters, and his work is in a number of outlets, including National Geographic and the Smithsonian Magazine. And Paul joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thank you for having me here.
Well, it's so great to have you. This book is so beautiful. Thank you for spending so much time putting this together. You know, Paul, over the last year, we have been doing a series on Japanese American internment, and we have met so many amazing people like you who had no idea that their parents and their grandparents were incarcerated because they never talked about it. So can you tell us?
Yeah, they never spoke about it.
When did you first learn about it?
You know, I was in my taking an American history class in San Mateo, and I was in 10th grade, and the teacher was talking about the Japanese incarceration during World War II, and I was really shocked because this is a subject we never spoke about at home. I never heard about it, so I was really shocked, and I had to go talk to my parents. What do you mean you guys were locked up? You guys were American citizens. How can that happen to you?
And so how did they respond? Because we had one man on our show who, for the first time, talked about it on the show. He'd never shared it with anyone else.
Yeah, my parents both kind of said, well, you know, we were taken away. We lived in these awful buildings. They were basically wood building, frame buildings with tar paper in the outside. They were mostly in desert, isolated locations, and they were very hot and dusty during the summer and very cold and during the wintertime. And they basically lost everything when they went.
When you originally wanted to interview your mom for this book, she said no. What was that conversation like?
Well, you know, after I learned about the incarceration, she told me, you know, stories about my family. And they lived on a farm in San Jose. They were very poor. And they also took my my grandfather, who had had a stroke before the war started, and he was bedridden. They took him to all the three camps that they went. They were in Santa Anita, and then they were in Arizona, the post and war relocation center. And she just said, you know, they were poor. They took the grandpa because they didn't want to leave him in San Jose to be, you know, they didn't know how people were going to treat him. And she just said it was hard. But when it came time for me, when I started interviewing people, and I wanted to have my mom's story because she knew more than a little more detail than what my dad would have said. She didn't want to go there. I think it was too painful for her to remember all that.
And then what ultimately led her to change her mind?
Well, you know, my mom never did. I never did interview her on that story. And then she passed away a few years later. And then I've talked to my dad, and my dad remembered, you know, stories like he was they were at the movies watching a movie. They came out. They're living in Oakland, California. My grandfather and had a dry cleaning business on Piedmont Avenue called Arthur's Cleaning and Dyeing. And they were at the movies theaters. So when they came out, they learned that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. Mm. So he told me about that, and he told me he went to they were at Tanfran and San Bruno, which is now a shopping center. It used to be a racetrack, and that's where most of the almost 8,000 Japanese Americans in the Bay Area were housed temporarily before they were sent to the permanent incarceration camps. And
Is everything okay at your studio, Paul?
Yeah, sometimes the headphones go in and out, so.
Okay, that's what's happening. All right, we'll try to get that fixed. We'll call the studio engineer on our end. I was wondering.
Yeah, Paul, it sounded like headphones are going in and out?
Yeah. Yeah, right now it seems like
let's take a little break. I'm going to read from Paul's book so they can fix that on their end, because that's really annoying for someone who's being interviewed and the headphones are going out. Why don't you take a minute, Paul, and I'll just read from some of your book. So today we are speaking with Paul Kitagaki about his new book, Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. He writes, like many sensei or third generation Japanese Americans, I learned in my American history class that my parents and grandparents were forcibly removed from their homes and taken to incarceration camps during World War II. Until then, not a word of what happened was ever passed down in family stories. About 70,000 of the more than 110,000 ethnic Japanese Americans taken away were native-born Americans. They were given but a few days to settle their financial affairs and report for transport to desolate detention centers away from the West Coast after President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. And then Paul goes on to write, I spent most of my childhood living less than 5 miles from the Tanforan racetrack. We drove past it visiting relatives in San Mateo, but not a word was spoken about the 4.5 months my dad and his family spent imprisoned there, despite the fact that dad's older brother Mario was serving in the U.S. Army before the attack on Pearl Harbor. No one talked either about my grandfather, who was forced to sell his business, Arthur's Dyeing Cleaning, on Piedmont Avenue in Oakland at a loss, giving up the home and back where his family lived. You know, over the past year, we've been doing a series on Japanese American internment, and we've heard the same story from so many people, that they did not know about their own family background. In fact, one of our guests said that her friend did a book report on her dad, and that's how she learned about him. That was Fred Korematsu. So if you'd like to give us a call, if you have a story to share, we'd love to hear from you. There's so many amazing books and documentaries out now, and so many Japanese Americans are doing actions down at the border to protest the now internment of children. So we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And today we are joined by Paul Kitagaki. He's an amazing photographer, and his new book is Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. And are you back with us, Paul?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
And, you know, my book has been based on 13 years of research, and it's based off my traveling photographic exhibit called Gambate, Legacy of an Enduring Spirit, which we just finished a five-month run at the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles. And the book is a result of my traveling exhibit, because everybody was wanting to have a book that they could share with people if they didn't see the exhibit. And we're still looking for more places to share the exhibit with.
How did people respond to the exhibit and the book so far? I mean, especially the people who are in the book.
It's been really an incredible It's been so incredible. I mean, like, it's when the photos have been shown in an exhibit, there's actually a lot of the stories that are in the book are at the exhibit, and people just stand there and just read every single word and look at, and they're just mesmerized by the stories. Because these are a lot of stories that, you know, like their parents hadn't really talked about, or maybe they talked about it in a very surfacey way, not surfacey, but, you know, just saying the conditions were bad, the food was bad, but they didn't tell you really what was in their heart, how it affected their family. And so many of the subjects' kids my age, the Sansei, third generation Japanese Americans, they really wanted to know what their parents had spoken about because they really didn't share those stories at home.
Yeah, and that was one of the themes when we've been doing these shows, is that they just didn't share much information. Let's talk about the inspiration to do this incredible project. So you were looking through photos at the National Archives back in 1984, and there you found a photo taken by Dorothy Lange, the famed documentary photographer, and the photo was of your dad and his parents boarding a bus in Oakland en route to a camp. What was it like for you when you first saw that photo?
Well, it was really incredible. But, you know, I didn't, when I started out as a photographer, my uncle, who's an artist in San Francisco, Nobu Kitagaki, he told me that Dorothea Lange had photographed our family. And Dorothea Lange was like one of my photographic heroes. I was like, I couldn't believe it. It's like, I was amazed. So when I had the chance to go back to Washington, D.C. I was covering Gary Hart for his presidential campaign. I went to the archives, and there's over 900 photographs of Dorothea Lange, and they're all in these shoe-sized boxes, and you flip through them, and there's these images that she shot, and on the back's like a caption. Most of them have no name, so you don't know who you're looking at. And so I was flipping through these boxes, these images were looking up at me and they staring up at me, and I really want to know, besides my family, who are what happened to them, because a lot of these photographs were like the iconic image of the incarceration. So when I found my family, I see my grandmother and my grandfather, and they're both smiling, they're looking up at this Caucasian lady, and my dad and my aunt are sitting next to them, and they're staring off kind of into space, kind of looking really lost. And it wasn't until years later my dad had told me that, oh, that's Dorothea Hightower. That's their family friend. And she had come to say goodbye to the family. And her family had also stored a lot of their personal belongings when they left.
So give us the backstory of Dorothy Lange. We did a show about a documentary that told the story about her. And it was so interesting to learn that the government wanted her to take photos that made it look like people in these camps were just having a good time in camp. And she wanted to really tell the true story. And the military seized these photographs and deposited them in the archives, where they remained mostly unseen and unpublished until around 2006. So it's such an interesting backstory. Can you talk more about that?
Well, actually, Dorothea Lange worked. She was hired by the War Relocation Authority, excuse me, and she was hired to document the incarcerations. She was one of a few photographers that were hired, and so she worked for them and she also shot people leaving before they left, during the leaving, inside some of the camps, and her photographs were. Put in the National Archives, but when they were printing her pictures, some of her pictures showed too much emotion, I think, for some of the government censors, and showed too much hardship on the Japanese Americans, because basically they were hired to try to show that people weren't being harmed. But her pictures didn't show people being harmed, but you could see the tragedy and all the hardship that was happening to them. And, you know, the first time I saw these photographs were in 1972. There's a book called Executive Order 9066, put out by the California Historical Society. And that's the first book that had many of her photographs and many of the other photographers' photographs. And that's really the very first time a lot of these photographs were shown. I mean, there's a book that came out later that showed some of the photographs had written on them on the pictures impounded, so they wouldn't be released to the public. But everything is still in the National Archives.
And it's amazing to talk about just the power of photography, Paul, given that you are an award-winning photographer. When we learned about Dorothy Lange and the photos that were censored in many ways, I was thinking about what happens when photos come out of the detention facilities today and just how powerful they are. I was thinking about the mom who was pulled over by, I believe it was the police, and her young girl was kind of grabbing under her legs and crying. And then I was thinking about the photos that we've seen of the foil blankets and just all of these young children in these cages and just the effect that these photos have had on society.
Yeah, you know, one of my subjects, Satsuki Ina, she's in Oakland, California. There's a photograph of her dad inside one of the jails in Tule Lake, which was in Northern California, one of the incarceration camps. And I also photographed her years later in that same jail cell. But she's leading, like we were talking about earlier this year, she was at Fort Sill protesting with other Japanese Americans, because they don't want this to happen to any other ethnic group. They're protesting at Fort Sills, which also held Japanese Americans during World War II. And that's also a place that they were thinking about housing the children that you were talking about, separated from their parents. So many of my subjects that I've interviewed and photographed, they've spoken out because they really don't want this to happen to anybody else just because of your race.
Right. Today we are speaking with Paul Kitagaki about his beautiful new book. It's a photo book along with stories, Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. And if you have any questions or comments for Paul, if you or someone you know, if you have connections to someone who was incarcerated, if your family was, or if you're just learning about this history, not just the surface history, because a lot of us were taught about this in school, but we didn't really get very deep. And so what are your thoughts about this? Questions you have? We'd love to hear from you. And also, if you'd like to talk about the power of photography, especially when we're talking about this kind of history, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Paul, in the book, you write that you found these photos that Dorothy Lange took, and as you flipped through the boxes of the images and searched for other photos, you realized that they contained many untold stories of the incarceration, stories that needed to be shared before the storytellers were gone. You write, "I wanted to find out what happened to the people in these pictures. Maybe I could find the answers that my parents never gave to me. The unknown faces embedded themselves in my soul, where they lay dormant, but not forgotten." So can you talk more about just what that feeling was like and why you ultimately decided to try to find the people in the photos?
Yeah, it's, you know, this was like since I was 16, and I've worked at 8 different newspapers on the West Coast. And I've during the course of that my career, I've done other stories on the incarceration. But I wanted to tell a story of not just my family. I wanted to tell a story of all these images, you know, that have been in my brain and have been seen, the iconic images of the incarceration. I wanted to find out what really happened to them. And, you know, I found one guy from Sacramento, Harvey Aitano, and he was the co-discoverer of the genetic cause of sickle cell anemia. I found another gentleman, Ben Kuroki. He flew 58 combat missions over Europe, 30 in Europe, and 28 over Japan in B-29 bombers and B-24 bombers. I met this incredible range of people and stories that I didn't know about.
What was the process like in tracking them down and then getting them to talk to you? Because, as you write, even though they had done nothing wrong, many just didn't want to talk about their experiences because of the shame and the pain that they still feel.
Yeah, I mean, it's when I started working on the project, I mean, I started with my family, but There's that book I was talking about, Executive Order 9066, published in 1972. And that was kind of like my starting point, because for me, those are all the iconic images. And so I made a poster of that, and I took it to one of the Japanese Buddhist churches in Sacramento. And they have a summer festival, and a lot of people come to have food and you know, play games and stuff. So I figured I'm going to put this board up there with my business card. And since there's some Sacramento images on that board, somebody's going to recognize somebody. Because we had to find somebody who would recognize somebody in the photograph that was taken over 70 years ago. Mm. And I put that up for the festival. I got not one call. I was like, oh, man, there's got to be somebody. So I was talking to somebody else in the community, Sacramento here, and they said, why don't you go down to the Japanese Methodist Church? They do this lunch for all the, you know, the Japanese seniors. So I took this same poster board down there, and somebody said, oh, I know who that is. And so from there, I got a name and a phone number, and I called them and trying to explain what I'm trying to do. You know, I'm trying to tell their story. And you know how, I don't know, it's really hard to, when I call people, to say, hey, I need to take a photograph of you. I'd like to, you know, make this photograph of you. And you know how everybody's like, oh, no, no. And then so it took me convincing to let me photograph them, and then also to let me tell their story. And so it was very hard and challenging.
And when you put up a poster at the Buddhist Church of, I'm sorry, at the Japanese United Methodist Church, someone there finally recognized Ted Miata. He was a soldier who returned home to help his mom harvest strawberries before she was sent to a detention center. And you actually connected with Ted's daughter, Donna Nakashima, who posed with her father's belongings. That must have been such an amazing experience for you.
Oh, it was so amazing. And and Ted was in the U.S. Army before the start of the World War II. And so when he came home to help his mom pick the strawberries, and the backstory on the mom is there was six kids, and the father, her husband, had won this car, and he tragically died in a car accident. So she's left to raise all these kids. So there was and Florin was a big Japanese farming community area in Sacramento, and so she worked at the strawberry basket making factory, and then her kids got together and bought and leased this plot of land, which is still there as an empty plot of land in Sacramento. It's at Power Inn and Road and Florin Road. And so when I found Donna and said, this is what I'm trying to do, I mean, I was like amazed that we came out, and she says, oh, I have my dad's flag when he passed away. And her dad also was a combat medic during World War II with the 442nd is a U.S. Army segregated Japanese-American unit, and they fought in Italy and France, and they're one of the most decorated combat units. So it was really amazing bringing her out to the same field that happened to have no buildings built on it after 70 years of photographing in that same spot where her grandmother and her father stood.
Wow. And you write that Donna's mom, Irene, was incarcerated at the Tule Lake Relocation Center in Newell, California. After Donna moved back to California in the 80s, her parents visited and sometimes joined former members from the Buddhist church for the long drive to the Tule Lake reunions. And Donna says, I wanted to go, but my mom said no. She said it was a bad memory for them. Even though they call it internment camp, my mom corrected me and said no, it was a concentration camp.
Yeah, and I also have people who have said, you know, because I ask everybody, what do you call it? Because the government name for it was a war relocation center, you know, kind of a nice name, doesn't sound bad. But I've had people call it concentration camps because they said there's barbed wire surrounding us. Yeah. We are guarded by armed guards with weapons. Some people say it was a prison camp. There's so many different terms, incarceration camp, internment camp. So everybody's got a different view depending, I think, on their age.
Right.
Being a child or being like a young adult.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and after the break, we will talk about more stories and learn about some of the other people that Paul photographed for this beautiful new book, Behind Barbed Wire, The Search for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. Paul Kitagaki is an award-winning photographer and videographer who's traveled the world covering natural and human-caused disasters. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. Toll free, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A, and the topic, Across America, Police Shootings and Transparency. The incident in Ferguson, Missouri, 5 years ago, led to many police departments using body cameras and increased transparency. But what about transparency around America? You'll learn more at 1A. At 11, join us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing the China cables. It's an unprecedented cache of classified government documents obtained by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, revealing the internal workings of detention camps holding over a million Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities in China. And then later in the show, we'll talk about how the housing crisis has forced thousands of families to live in their cars in Salinas and many other cities in California. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are speaking with Paul Kitagaki, an award-winning photographer, about his beautiful new book, Behind Barbed Wire, The Search for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. Paul's parents and grandparents were incarcerated in concentration camps, but like so many, they never talked about their experience. To better understand what they went through, Paul Kitagaki tracked down the subjects of more than 60 photographs taken by Dorothy Lange, Ansel Adams, and others, and he photographed them or their children. And they all say they're determined to make sure this never happens again. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you have a personal experience, if you have relatives who are incarcerated, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you just have a question for Paul about the many interactions he had, you can give us a call or email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Gareth in Corte Madera. Hi, Gareth. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, this triggered a memory of my family experience in Lancaster during World War II. I was born at the end of the war, so I was only told this story as I was growing up, of how my father, who was a Methodist minister and also a conscientious objector against World War II at the time, was asked by a Japanese family that was a member of his church to look after their farm as they were being taken off to the concentration camp that they were going to be put in during the course of the war. And my father and his wife, my mother, did, and I just recently stumbled upon a photograph, like just yesterday, I stumbled upon a photograph of her in the fields harvesting their asparagus. And so, you know, the synchronicity here of this program being aired and my discovery of this, my memories coming flooding back of this story are making me a little verklempt.
Wow. I can't imagine. I mean, the thing that's amazing, Gareth, is that, you know, we've been doing this series for the last year, and we've just had on so many amazing people who have very similar stories to the one you're sharing.
Yeah, I think it was especially the case around Lancaster because I think there was a large air base there, maybe still is.
Hmm.
That they were especially diligent about making sure that they had anybody of Japanese ancestry hauled away.
Wow! So where do you plan to take this from here?
Well, actually, there's another thing which just I remembered also just now. My father reported to me that at the conclusion of the war, he was invited to talk to the local Rotary Club, and what he chose as his topic was how the Society of Lancaster should welcome back the Japanese internees and restore to them their land and welcome them back into the community. and several people in the Rotary Club got up and left while he was talking. So that speaks to how fraught this issue was then, and how much of a scar it still has in our society now.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Gareth. And if you go to kalw.org, there's a drop-down menu under Your Call. And if you click on Here, you can find all of the shows that we've done over the past year about Japanese-American internment. It's Histories of Exclusion and Resistance. Paul, what are your thoughts on Gareth's comment?
You know, there were so many people that helped other Japanese Americans, and there's also people who took advantage of them. One of my subjects, she became a school teacher, but her dad had a nursery in Hayward. Her name was Mei Yanagi. She's here in Sacramento. But so her dad had this really successful nursery in the San Leandro area. So they left it in the care of a person. And so when they came back, the guy had sold their business and sold everything from them. They had no home to come back to, no business. So what happened with her family is her dad had moved, then her dad moved up to the Berkeley area and just started being a gardener. But she became the first person in her family to ever go to college. And she became a school teacher. But, you know, it was really interesting. As a school teacher, she never really spoke about the incarceration. And her younger sister, who was also photographed by Dorothea Lange, also became a school teacher. And her sister never spoke about the incarceration while she was teaching. Every time she'd think about it, her sister said she would start to choke up and not be able to speak about it.
Wow.
But the injustice of what happened, I mean, her father knew the injustice of what happened, and it really – really was really hard on him and the family.
Wow. Well, thank you again so much for calling in, Gareth. Let's go next to Tom in Santa Cruz. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Howdy. I have a very interesting experience. I grew up after the war in war-torn sections of Germany and France. I knew war really well by just observing. All that stuff didn't come into my mind later till I was in my 20s. And by that time, I was anti-militarist because of the Vietnam War. We moved and I was from a military family. We moved to Santa Barbara, California. And I don't know how, but my new dentist was a guy named Dr. Nakaji. And Dr. Nakaji and I would joke around. He'd, you know, oh, you need to brush here. Oh, that's a funny-looking molar. Whatever he said, it was affable. At some point along the line, I picked up a paperback called America's Concentration Camps. What's this? I read it. I was horrified. Then I asked, in my next visit, I asked, so Dr. Nakaji, what was this all about? And I explained what the title was about, and he never again, I had gotten under his skin without meaning to.
Wow.
He was too shameful, as shame, you know, came down on almost all the victims of this horrible thing. And as a growing and now practically classic expert on the American concentration camps and the Nazi death camps, I've been to Heart Mountain twice, very eerie, I want to come back to that, Poston once, Tule Lake three times or four, and definitely Manzanar about eight times sleeping overnight. Now, what's so eerie about Heart Mountain is there's that beautiful mountain which gives the name to the area. And I was remembered being there and seeing all of the concrete foundations of the long vacated, you know, this expensive wood. I mean, it's a place that doesn't have much wood. But what was left was one tall chimney. And it's eerie because it suggested that, oh, well, we'll just start burning them. Now, that never happened as far as I know. But it made me sensitive to the whole issue that America has this whole shame thing, the schizophrenic shame thing about, you know, what we did, oh, we didn't do anything to black people, didn't do anything to Jews. Oh, Irish people coming, and Catholics too. Oh, my gosh, Japanese? I don't know. What? And so America is very, we don't have a sense of history and how to learn from it. And that bothers me because I teach history, and I teach this stuff, and only one of my colleagues gets around to it too. But when I dig into it, I know I didn't have anything to that effect when I was taking it back in the 60s.
Mm.
And last thing.
Sure.
And I have a a now retired Japanese American colleague, and he knows my interest. And I asked him, "What do you know?" And he had a horrible story about how his uncle was in the 442nd and did this and that. But anyway, I it's a shame thing with Japanese Americans why they didn't do well, and it clammed up as it was with Jews after the war, mistreated so horribly. They knew in the culture that they were in, they couldn't speak out until a new generation might speak up and out and research. But now we forget, and it's all repeated again with at the American border.
Well, thank you for calling in, Tom. What about this, Paul, about the history we learn and don't learn? Our producer, Leah Cesarine, just told me that she never learned about any of this in school.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so important. I've been trying to do this work because I wanted to have this book be in schools, libraries, because, you know, there really isn't, like, there might be like one little sentence speaking about this subject, but a lot of people across the country I've talked to, I mean, they never knew about this when they were growing up.
Right.
And so I think it's so important to share the story and get it out there. And especially with what we have here in the book and in my exhibit, is that you have a personal connection with it, because you have these personal stories, and you could actually, instead of being like one of my subjects says, you know, everybody got a tag with a number when they were rounded up, right, and went to showed up. And one of my subjects says, you know, that's what we were reduced to, a number. Hmm. And they weren't a number. They were a person and a human. And I think their stories hopefully would resonate with somebody else, so hopefully this couldn't happen again.
Well, we have a related question from Fran, who says, for better or worse, many of us learn about history from films and television. Think Schindler's List. I read that AMC's show The Terror was the first time that television had addressed the Japanese internment in a TV show or movie, and this was season 2 this year. An internment camp was the setting for the show. Fran says, I'm wondering why it took so long for this to happen and why your guest thinks that this is so hidden from a popular culture point of view.
I don't think the story's been hidden. I mean, there was, remember, Return to Manzar was with their very first film that talked the incarceration. And that was back in, I'm not sure which year it was, but it was like 80s or 80s. And that's the very first film that spoke about, you know, showed the incarceration. So I don't think it's been hidden. It's just trying to educate more people so this doesn't happen. Just get the story out there.
Well, thank you for the email, Francis. We have another email from Anna Marie, who says, thank you so much for doing programs on this subject. My grandma was incarcerated at Tule Lake when she was in her 20s and recently just passed away at the age of 100. Wow. As a child, I knew about the internment, but my grandma did not easily share stories or speak about her time there, and neither did my many great aunts and uncles who were also interned. I wanted to keep asking, but it always felt like prying, since there's so much shame surrounding the subject within the community. How have you made the delicate balance of bringing up triggering history with this generation in your interviews for your amazing research, while also trying to respect their desire for privacy, since it is such a subject of shame within their generation?
Well, you know, there's a Japanese, couple of Japanese concepts. There's a word called shigatakanai, which means, you know, it can't be helped. So they just kept on moving on with life. And for my exhibit, there's a word, a Japanese word called gambate, which means to triumph over adversity, never giving up, and always trying to do your best. And I think that's what that generation did. You know, my parents' generation, my grandparents, even after this happened to them, they kept on. They had to rebuild and restart life, and hope for a better life for their children. So I think a lot of times they didn't talk about it because of the shame, because they were American citizens and they did nothing wrong. And there was never any acts of sabotage by the Japanese-American community during World War II. So I think they wanted their children like me and my children to have a good life with none of this holding them back.
Wow. Well, thank you for calling, Anna Marie, and how lucky you are to have your grandma until age 100. And again, in case you didn't hear earlier, we've been doing an entire series on Japanese American incarceration and modern civil liberties issues. And you can find all of those shows at KALW.org. Click Your Call and then click on Here. And that's Histories of Exclusion and Resistance. We have another email from Philip. He says, I'm sure that any sensitive persons who have had the privilege of seeing the artwork that was made by internees at the camps exhibited at the Folk Art Museum on Mission Street in San Francisco several years ago will never forget the beauty, originality, and vitality of the paintings and the sculpture. Unfortunately, it's now closed. He says it speaks to the indomitable spirit of human creativity, even in the most depressing and adverse circumstances. What are your thoughts about that, Paul? Because as you point out in the book, some of the people you talked to and their kids wanted to forget. Some wanted to remember. Some lost everything. Some found new direction. But what about this speaking to the spirit of human creativity?
One of my subjects, her mom was a famous watercolor artist, and her father was too. They're both artists, and they taught art classes in the camps there. And her mom had these fantastic watercolors that are in the Japanese American National Museum now of the incarceration experience in Topaz. It's really incredible. And there's another woman who wrote, who did this book, The Art of Gaman, which had, like you said, all the little artifacts and artwork, little birds, painted birds, and all these different things that everybody had made while they were incarcerated. And it's really incredible that in those harsh conditions, they take scrap pieces of wood. Like my grandfather made furniture, chairs, and I still have a couple of chairs that he made from the scrap wood. But they would carve and make animals or, you know, just build things and create artwork. It was really incredible that they were able to do that under those harsh conditions.
Yeah, under those very harsh conditions. Thank you again for calling in. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are speaking with Paul Kitagaki, an award-winning photographer and videographer who has traveled the world covering natural and human-caused disasters. And he's out with an incredible new book, Behind Barbed Wire, The Search for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. And we're almost out of time, Paul, but I wonder, what is going to happen with the traveling exhibit in case people would like to see it?
Yeah, I'm trying to find out. It just finished in Los Angeles. It's been in like 8 different locations across the U.S., but I'm trying to find more locations and sponsors to help show and exhibit the work. And so I hope we could find somebody else to bring it. I'd like to bring it to the South, to the East Coast, more essential, all over the place. Mm. So, because there's so many people, like we talked about earlier, that really don't know the story, or it was not in the history books, or maybe there's one sentence about it in the history books.
Right.
And it's been brought up so much more recently with politics, right?
Right. And people like Gareth, who, you know, found some photos and is just now learning about his family's history.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing, the person who's asking about how do I get the subjects to share their stories. I mean, basically, we have a conversation. It's not like about their experience in whatever, you know, there's some basic questions, but then we kind of have a conversation. I think a lot of times it's easier for the subjects to talk to somebody who's outside their family, not like their children or something, about something like this. Mm-hmm. And then I think once I show people, some of the people I've talked to, and I think they were able to, and they saw the exhibit started, it took me 7 years to find 12 people. Hmm. So when I first did the story in 2012, it was like the 70th anniversary of signing of Executive Order 9066, and we had some stories, and I said, I'm still looking for more people, and I had a gallery of more people I'm looking for. And then we have a permanent exhibit right now at the San Bruno BART station in Tanfran, which is where most of the Bay Area people were. And since then, I've expanded the exhibit to 30, which was the first exhibit was at the California Museum in 2015. And since then, we have 61. And I'm actually photographing another person tomorrow, and I've photographed three other people earlier this year. So wow. I'm still adding to the body work, and I'm still looking for more people and to try to tell their stories before they're all gone.
Well, I mean, every story is just so incredible. Before we end, and we don't have that much time, let's talk about Dino Helene Nakamoto, Helene Nakamoto Mahara.
Oh, sure.
And Yoko Itashiki, who is now Mary Ann Yahiro. I mean, I love all of this, but I especially love the photographs of these people when they were young, and then you ended up finding them so many years later. And that's the case for Helene and now Marianne. So tell us a little bit about them.
It's incredible. Somebody contacted me, or somebody gave me Helene's number, and I talked to her. She lives in Los Angeles area. And at the time, Marianne was living in the Chicago area. And I was able to, and this photograph is one that Dorothea Lang had photographed, the two of them reciting the Pledge of Allegiance at their school in San Francisco. It's an incredible photograph. Mm-hmm. Them with their schoolmates. And it was like one of the iconic picture. I mean, it's one of the iconic pictures. So I was able to connect with them and meet them in San Francisco right at the same place where the photograph was taken, this school. It was called the Raphael Wiles School in San Francisco, which is now the Rosa Parks School. And it's right there in Japantown in San Francisco. But it's incredible because when I found out about the girls with Helene, my parents would shop at her dad's store, which is called American Fish Market in San Francisco. And the other incredible thing is both parents were arrested right after Pearl Harbor. Helene's father, who ran the market, was a businessman. So he was on the list, and he was arrested right away. And then Mary Ann's mom taught Japanese. So, you know, they arrested right after the war, priest, businessman. And so they arrested both of them. And for Mary Ann, it's really sad because she said she didn't see her mom. She never saw her 51-year-old mother alive again after when they took her. Because she died in captivity. And when they brought her back, they were living in Topaz in the Utah desert. She said they brought her body back for her funerals in Topaz. And she said, you know, it's really hard for me seeing her like that when I hadn't seen her in a long time. But the incredible thing is, she said, I don't have any bitterness. And I was like, well, I couldn't believe what she said. I just was so amazing.
That was amazing. But I don't have bitterness. Were you, I mean, what was your reaction when you heard her say that?
I mean, that's such a traumatic thing to be, you know, have your mom separated by FBI agents and then you don't see her again. And then you see her. I was just totally moved. I was wordless. like I am now.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. And then for Helene, she said, these men in fedora hats came to the house and hurriedly took him, her father, out of the house. I was at the top of the staircase watching, yeah. And I remember the flashing lights, and he was gone. That's it. And we didn't see him for 15 months.
Yeah, it was incredible. And then the other awful thing for her, she had a brother, and when they moved to the campus, he was just 18 months old, and he developed whooping cough and measles, and he died in Topaz. Mm. And the other really weird kind of side note to this thing, on the day I photographed the two women, my mom was just up the street having surgery at the Kaiser, and then she passed away after her surgery. It was like it was a weird kind of day for me.
Oh,
it was
wow.
Like one of, and they were one of the first few people I've had photographed.
Wow. That is amazing, Paul. I mean, and also just for you as a photographer, you've done so much incredible work, but this project is so near and dear to your heart. I mean, what was it like, for example, to photograph Helene and Marianne in front of their old school?
You know, it was such an incredible experience. They hadn't seen each other since they were kids.
Wow.
You know, before they were schoolmates. Mm. And it was really incredible to see them together. And then their husbands were there with them. It was just incredible. And then, you know, just the what's that, the right word where things are just removed by one person or something? I mean, like for me, like we'd shop at her dad's fish market, you know, the American fish market in Japantown. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I remember going to the store, you know, and it was just incredible to, you know, here's the people that are in your community that you know, but you didn't know. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right. Well, and it's also, you hear about Japanese internment, but the stories, I mean, losing fathers, losing moms, losing brothers. I mean, everybody has a story. And to bring it to where we are today, all of the people who are being held in these cages have stories. Just final thoughts, Paul. We don't have much time left. But what really struck sure. you when you interviewed people who are showing solidarity with immigrants from Central America today and speaking out about immigrant detention?
Well, Satsuki Ina is one of the ones she's speaking out. She was one of the ones I was talking about. She was photographed in the jail. And she led a protest in Fort Sill's earlier this year in Oklahoma. And they're also doing a protest next year in Washington, D.C. in June, protesting the incarceration of all these the kids, the children. Mm-hmm. And but it was just, you know, everybody since 9/11, I think they really wanted to speak out because they didn't want this to happen to another. They saw what was happening to other ethnic groups, and they didn't want this to happen to anybody else. And I think that's why a lot of them have really spoken out and have been able to share their stories today, because they really don't want this to happen to anybody else.
Mm. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. It's such a beautiful book.